This tape is a production of All Roads Ministry. Your speaker is Vin Lewis, founder and president. This tape consists of a series of telephone conversations between another person and the other person had questions which a nun was asking, dealing primarily with prayer, salvation, etc. Some of the technical quality is not the greatest, but I think you'll be able to benefit by listening to these questions and answers, and I think in most cases you'll be able to understand clearly what was being driven at. Thank you.
Well, this is Walt. I have a friend, Patty Lynch, who is going to be a nun with the Missionaries of Charity, and she has asked our Lord to allow her to have purgatory on earth rather than after death. And so the question is with the mission that they have of ministering to the poorest of the poor, and she's trying, and part of that is saving souls. And her question is, when is it that she is working off her time in purgatory, and when is her time for saving souls? Like, does she pray for to lessen her time in purgatory one day, and then to use the grace for saving souls
sure.
The next?
Okay. Yeah, I think I got it straight.
Okay.
What we're talking about is, as far as offering up things, as far as motivation, as far as prayer life, etc., is she, what proportion should she be devoting to, quote, unquote, selfishly trying to reduce her time in purgatory, and what portion should she be devoting her efforts to the salvation of souls other than her own?
Exactly.
Is that essentially it?
Exactly.
Okay. What I am saying is it should be 100% towards purgatory and zero towards the salvation of other souls. The reason is salvation is a gift. In the truest sense of the word, it has conditions with it, and once we're given salvation, we have to maintain it by our good works, by our prayer life, by our spirituality, etc. But it is a gift. It is a gift from God to man. It is a gift from God to every individual man. God has his own mysterious ways by which he works out the possibility of salvation of every man. We are required to work out our own salvation in fear and trembling. We cannot work out the salvation of others. We cannot be the reason another person gets to heaven. We cannot achieve the salvation of other people. That the salvation of people is achieved through the gift of God and through the shed blood of Jesus on the cross. So there's two points here. Number one, God will work out the plan by which he has, by which each man may come to a knowledge of the truth and be saved, whether we cooperate with it or not. If we fail to, quote, preach the gospel to someone, God will bring up someone else, or he'll use another instrument by which that person will receive the gospel message. We, however, still have to, of course, by maintaining our own, you know, doing our own good work, we maintain our salvation and get closer to God and all of that stuff. But the two reasons why I'm saying she should go totally towards purgatory, remission of her temple punishment and purgatory, is number one, you are not able to bring about a change in anybody else's relationship with God. It simply cannot be done. We have to work as if we can. This is one of the paradoxes of Christianity, which is essentially that we work as if everything depends on us. We pray as if everything depends on God. But let's be realistic. Everything really depends on God. We still we preach the gospel. We still feed the hungry. We clothe the naked. And as I point out all the time, no matter how many people we feed, no matter how often they die eventually anyway. So from a purely rationalistic point of view, it's silly to feed them at all, since they're simply going to die. They're putting all that food to waste, quote-unquote, because they don't live forever. But we still do it for good reasons, and the good reasons are God has ordained that we're supposed to do it, and we benefit from that. So, number one, if you are to devote X pressure, say, time, effort, prayer, etc., to somehow reinforcing God's effort, you are quite literally, in the true sense of the word, wasting it. You're wasting your time, you're wasting your effort. Number two, there is a possible occasion of sin here, which can lead to the temptation that God depends upon us to bring about the salvation of others. Once we start praying that God will do what God is supposed to do, it's not too far logically to go from that position to God is waiting for us to pray for others, to God depends on us to pray for others, that God needs us to pray for others, and pretty soon we can get into a very delusional state of thinking we're really important in the scheme of other people's salvation. We're not. We must always remember that. The only salvation we have any influence on is our own. The reason why we preach, the reason why we bear witness, the reason why we do good works, the reason why we do all of this is for our own sake. And Jesus sort of put it in a very, very earthly, very clear fashion. What does it benefit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul? Now, he gains the whole world, even if he gained the whole world for Christ and lost his soul, it did him no good at all. The only thing that matters in life, and literally in death, is salvation versus damnation. That's number one. But once that is settled, the only thing that matters then is avoiding purgatory or reducing time as little as possible. For the very obvious reason that it is a very beneficial, without qualification, a very beneficial thing for a human being to pay the debt incurred by his or her sin. Therefore, if you do a purely beneficial thing for a good reason, and that's what your purgatory is satisfying God's justice. That is a perfectly good thing. If you do that, no one can criticize you under any circumstances whatsoever. So the satisfaction that one would achieve by trying to cut down its temporal punishment is a perfectly good act with no qualification whatsoever, with no danger, with no temptation. After all, what is ultimately the person saying when he is saying he's trying to cut down on the time in purgatory is he's saying he's trying to get to heaven as soon as possible after death, which means what? He wants the supreme good, the supreme joy of the beatific vision as soon as possible. This cannot be a bad act. This is the supreme good. You are to desire. You are required to desire the supreme good, and desire carries in it the necessary implication of wanting it as soon as possible. So, that argument for working for purgatory is completely independent of a comparison. If you examine it in absolute terms, it is a perfect good for a perfectly good reason, with no implications of occasion of sin or temptation. If you compare it with the other, it is superior because, number one, it is something that is achievable. While you cannot, again, achieve the salvation of someone else by prayer, you cannot achieve the salvation of anybody else by good works, because the other person is always supreme in his own will, and you cannot force a person to change his will. All you can do is try to influence him. All you can do is try to add a whole bunch of little tiny grains of sand to a huge balance beam, and yet he still will make his own decision whether to accept God or not. So therefore, first of all, on the absolute sense, purgatory is better, but on the comparative sense, purgatory is better because purgatory is achievable, the other is not. But number two, purgatory has no negative aspects to it, and the other concept, this concept of working and offering up, etc., for the salvation of others, that's different. That's different, because that is, again, could lead to that implication that somehow the salvation of others depends upon us, and that is a very, very dangerous thing to take seriously. I fully admit and agree and am knowledgeable of that there are certain messages which have been given, particularly at Fatima and other places, which give the distinct impression that salvation of other people is dependent upon us. But I think if you examine these correctly, These are, again, these paradoxical statements in which we're saying that we have to work as if the salvation of others is dependent upon us. Again, this is a very simple analogy. Every time people have sexual intercourse, they do not conceive a child. The only reason they conceive a child at a certain time is because God makes a specific act to infuse a soul in the union of that act. If God chose not to infuse the soul, then people could have sex from now until the day they died, and no children would ever be conceived. Any person who thinks that he actually conceives a child, or she actually conceives a child, even though we use this language in our everyday life, is a fool. It is only the specific act of God that brings about the creation of a human being. We humans are allowed to cooperate in it, but clearly, again, God, as in the creation of Adam and Eve and in the incarnation, can bypass this system or short circuit or only use half of it. We have a normal way and we have the divine way. And the divine way includes the normal way but sometimes goes around it. And what I'm saying is, again, if we think that the salvation of others is dependent upon us, we are in heretical ground. However, we should function as if the salvation of others depends upon us in the same sense that we should feed the hungry and clothe the naked as if they will never die. We are still required to deal with people on their deathbed as if they're going to be alive forever. We have to treat people in a certain sense, they call it disinterestedly. In other words, we cannot treat, as St. James puts, we cannot treat the rich man better than the poor man because the rich man can pay us back. It's exactly the point. Even though we all know the rich man can pay us better than the poor man and probably be more influential and more of a help to us, we have to make the conscious effort to treat these people with equality. And that's what I'm saying is there's paradoxes here. Christianity is full of paradoxes. The incarnation is a paradox, okay? And what I'm simply saying is, as I guess a summary statement is, that if you were to work on the concept of offering these things up for the conversion of other people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, this is dangerous, because from that, intellectually, can follow the implication that God's grace is not sufficient, but he needs us, and that's utter, complete nonsense. And again, this does not mean to say that one shouldn't offer up one's reparation for the suffering souls in purgatory already. That's an act of love, and that's something achievable, but they're already saved, so that's a different story, okay? You're just trying to get these people out quicker, and that's a separate matter. But purgatory versus, shall we say, rewards on earth or achievable increase of virtue on earth, no. To me, it's 100% purgatory and 0% on earth for the reasons I've said, and I hope that's clear. Okay, is that it, Walt?
Okay, let me ask you this real quick. What, it is through the sufferings and the deprivations and the things that she's going to undergo that is going to build up graces for her that will reduce her time in purgatory? And
well, grace is not the proper word. Essentially, everybody who sins incurs debt. Okay. The concept of justice has two things. One is punishment, the other is restitution. In a certain sense, you know, like the guy who breaks your window, he may give you the money, but the police may still want to talk to him, okay, because he's broken the money. You know, we do this all because he's broken the window. So, and again, even if the police or the judge doesn't prosecute him, he still owes you the money. So there's two concepts here. One is putting things back the way they were, and the other is the simple concept of punishment. The punishment concept in pretty much is gone because of, in confession, through the merits of Jesus and the saints, etc. But the restitution concept, we still have to make things right. We still have done something wrong with our soul. We have to restore it. We have to be healed, is a separate matter. So one could look at purgatory as a healing process that we go through after a significant operation or something like that. It isn't grace, really. It's a payment. And in a certain sense, a very simple way to look at it is you've got a bank account. It might be in a debit situation where you owe the bank money. When you die, there'll be an account, and they'll say, well, you owe us, you know, $5,000, and you'll look in your wallet and see what you got. If you got $5,000, hey, the bank doesn't bother you anymore. If you don't, well, like the restaurants say, go and wash dishes for a while. And that's essentially the situation. She is encouraged, we're all encouraged, to try to build up a credit account so by the time we die, there'll be nothing to owe. And, of course, we can apply that to other people. How's that? Understandable?
And if, so, like, say, she goes out and spends time with these poor people, feeding them and clothing them and everything, and I don't. Now then, so by her doing that, she is going well do more for cutting her time down in purgatory than I am.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And so it's the good works that she's doing is what is going to, and the suffering that she's going to endure, is going to reduce her time in purgatory.
Right.
And okay, so that's the way it goes, and so everything that she's doing here is well, to reduce her time in purgatory, and the person that she's talking to may or may not get their soul saved.
Yeah, again, it's always up to that individual whether to accept Jesus or not. I mean, you know, to use the Protestant expression, that's really what it is accepting Jesus as your personal savior. If you do, and if you mean it, ultimately you will be saved. If you don't, you won't.
Right. And so she's going to be out there for the rest of her life trying her best to bring as many souls to God as she possibly can, but all of this is going to be to her merit, to whether they come in or not.
Yes, she should be working as if it really matters, but in reality, it doesn't. None of us can change a person's will. God himself will not change a person's will because God has created us with a free will, which is always supreme. It is the will which ultimately determines where a person winds up. So, again, you know, the old expression, you lead a horse to water, you can't make him drink. You can present all the truths of Catholicism to anybody, but that doesn't mean they'll accept them. I mean, after all, you know, Satan lived with God.
Yeah.
He knew this stuff. I mean, there was nobody needed to preach to him the gospel. He knew God. He was in heaven, and he chose to reject it. Well, how could you have prevented that? The only way you could have prevented that, the only way God could have prevented that, is by literally either causing Satan to cease to exist or preventing him from having a free will. As long as people have free will, they will make their own ultimate choice of whether to get to heaven or hell. And there's nothing we can do to change a person's free will. But when we have sinned, it has been our own fault and not because of our parents. Yet we also know that we try to influence our children and take and feel as if we are responsible for these things. But we're not, you know. But it's a good thing to feel that way. It's a good thing to function as if these things matter.
Okay, well, listen, thank you a lot. And I'll call you back at around 2 o'clock.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
That ends the first tape. The second tape also has some technical problems, but I believe everything is understandable. With that, we go to the next series.
Conversion.
Yeah, I could hear it. I'm not quite sure if I understood her, so I'll make an attempt. Okay?
All right.
Let me try to rephrase it, because if I rephrase it and then she agrees with the rephrasing, then I've answered the question correctly.
Right, good.
Okay. We cannot change anybody else's will. However, can we not, quote-unquote, speed it up by adding a little bit extra to the matter?
Okay.
What I'm saying is, let me try to use a simple analogy. We have the Queen Mary. And the Queen Mary is going across the ocean. And obviously, a factor involved in the Queen Mary and how fast it goes across the ocean is the waves and the wind and the water temperature and the efficiency of the engines and the propellers. Another factor is how much the ship weighs. Now, you want to get across the ocean as quickly as possible. You notice a fly or a mosquito on the railing. You kill it, throw it in the ocean, and say, well, I guess we're going to get there more quickly, aren't we? In a certainly theoretical sense, you could say, yes, we've lightened the weight of the ship. but it is so little a factor that it means nothing. Yes, St. Monica prayed. I dealt with this recently, and I would suggest if she wants, she gets the tape. I dealt with this recently at the house, Christmas house party of William Mara, who she might be familiar with, of Keep the Faith at Fordham University. And he raised the issue that this was one of the reasons he had objected to me, is because in the Christmas party before, I had objected that St. Monica didn't have anything to do with the salvation of St. Augustine. And I still hold that. If we change our point of view from what we do to what God does, I think it becomes clearer. If we look at it from God's point of view, God is, by definition, all-loving, all-powerful, all-merciful, all-compassionate. All of the words start with the word all, which means, by definition, there is no room for improvement, and there can be no addition. We cannot add to God's power. If we could add to God's power, he wouldn't be God. He'd be some kind of an angel or demigod or something else. We cannot add to God's power. We cannot add to God's knowledge. We cannot add to God's love. So, what God does in his relation with any individual, and all individuals, but let's just deal with some hypothetical guy that this lady will come across in the future. Let's call him just so we get a question. Let's call the lady who asked the question, Mary. Let's call the guy who she's going to deal with 9 years from now, Thomas, just so we can make it concrete rather than abstract. Thomas right now is outside the church. He's an anti-Catholic Baptist or something like that. Mary comes along and shows him that Catholics can be good. She points out some of the fallacies of his intellectual objections to Catholicism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If he then converts, quote-unquote, because of the result of Mary's actions, we would have to say that God was specifically and intentionally withholding the grace that would bring Thomas into the church for 9 years, from today's date until the time Mary meets him 9 years from now. For God to withhold such grace would put God as a necessary instrument of sin, because disbelief is sin. I think this is the problem we sometimes fail to understand. We can all fully comprehend anger, lust, gluttony, drunkenness as sin. We certainly understand that no man is forced to stop at a bar on the way home from work, drink, turn his paycheck into money, drink all of his paycheck down, then go home and beat his wife. Now, under no circumstances do we say, well, he didn't know better. No, we know he knows better, and under no circumstances can we say, well, someone put a gun to his head and made him do this. Nonsense. We consider this guy a bum, because what he did was very sinful. Agreed. To disbelieve is sinful. What is required of belief is the submission of the will to God's will. Very simple. If somebody says somewhere along the line is, God, let me know what's really going on and what you want me to believe. End of discussion. When you do that sincerely, God, who the Bible says in the Gospel, in the Epistle of St. James, who can withhold nothing good from us, will automatically, at that instant, enlighten that person. Why? Because if he does not do so, he allows that man to stay in disbelief, which is sin. Sin. And God never allows man to stay in sin except by the conscious activity of man. And we follow this through the concept of disbelief and sin. If you must be a Catholic to get to heaven, if you must, as the Athanasian Creed says, hold, complete, and inviolate the Catholic faith to get to heaven, then those who do not hold the faith complete cannot be saved, and therefore incur sin, and therefore go to hell, or are damned, or are punished for that sin, at least. We don't know what it is. Let's not even comment about their end. But let's say they're in sin. We're born in original sin, which is removed by baptism. If baptism does not take place, we carry that original sin throughout our lives. We remain in sin. Disbelief is sin. The man who was not St. Augustine before his conversion was in sin. Sin is opposed to God. God always provides enough grace, help, aid, enlightenment. Doesn't matter what word we use. Presence, inspiration. Again, I don't care what word we use. God always does enough so that every man, at every moment of his life, may choose the good and reject the evil. Always. Therefore, every man who remains outside of the church, every man who objects to the church, every man who does not convert, and you can only convert yourself in that sense, is in sin. And God does not wait for us to act against sin. So therefore, her act couldn't possibly hurry up a man's conversion. Utterly impossible. Because what you are doing is adding to God. And you're adding to the personal relationship between God and man. And you can't do that. This does not mean to say that God doesn't love some of us more than others. That's a separate matter. I personally hold he does. So therefore, I'm sure he favors some over others. But we're not talking about favoring here. We're talking about sufficiency. Again, God always gives man enough grace to at any moment choose good and avoid evil. And any man who stays outside of the church is sinful. And the only way he can do this is by rejecting the grace of God or failing to call on the grace of God. Now, one could argue that if I meet Thomas 9 years from now and say to Thomas, and I suggest this all the time, Thomas, tonight go home when you're alone, when you're calmed down, when you're no longer emotionally angry at me because I confronted you, and get down on your knees and say, God, give me the truth. And God will then respond to you. If you do that, the next day you'll understand where truth is and you'll understand you were wrong. Well, one could argue, well, gee whiz, okay, I could hurry up his conversion by telling him to do that. Yes, you could. But the point is, the fact that Thomas didn't do this until 9 years from now when he's asked to do so is a sin of sloth. Sloth is one of those temptations which lead to a capital sin, and sloth is not taking the actions which are required of you in your state of being or your state of life simply because of a disinclination to work hard or make the effort. Any man who does not say to God, either, God, I'm on the path with you, and I'm going along correctly, keep me there, or, Lord, I'm not on the path with you, put me on it. Any man who doesn't do that is sinfully slothful. And if he does not repent of that sin, it is enough to damn him. Because he is, in the true sense of the word, committing a sort of human self-abuse. He is not using himself the way he is intended to be, which is for the goodness and glory of God and for the spread of God's kingdom. And the only way we can really spread it is one at a time, by volunteering, okay, joining God's army in the recruitment. We can try to recruit people, but we really can only volunteer. So again, the basic reason why what she said was wrong, well, I have to be careful. I think she posed it as a question, so I'm not saying she's wrong. She posed it as a problem, okay? So I'll be careful about that. I'm not attacking her. I'm trying to answer. The basic reason why, to make it again very concrete, the basic reason why St. Monica's prayers did not work on St. Augustine is contained in the title of St. Augustine's book, Confession. He was confessing a sin that he was in for a long period of time. And the reason he was in sin is because he was rejecting the grace of God. And God did not, to use a very crude image, sit up on the throne, sort of bored until St. Monica prayed, and then said, oh, by the way, yes, I have to worry about St. Augustine. No. God had the personal relationship with St. Augustine from the moment of St. Augustine's conception, which literally will carry out through all eternity. And that personal relationship, because God is not tired and God does not get distracted, God does not forget, meant that in every moment of St. Augustine's existence, not only did God guide every single corpuscle of blood through his lungs and his veins and his arteries and his heart, not only did he make sure that every single synapse worked, so every single nerve function got through from his fingers to his head and back to his feet again, not only did God do that, but God worked on it every day. And even if you want to take a slightly distracted view, remember that each human being is assigned a guardian angel, who is a vastly powerful, significant, massive intellect, spiritual personality, with the goal of working on it, with the goal of inducing us to good. Then, throw in with that, you got a conscience. A conscience, which is a divine gift given by God to man, by which man can learn what is good and avoid what is evil. Now, if one follows his conscience for 30, 40 seconds, one will come to the conclusion, among other things, that abortion is wrong and marriage should be forever. Then if he spends another 30 or 40 seconds looking around, he'll find there's only one church that teaches this, and that is ours. So therefore, he will come to the conclusion that the true church is the Catholic Church, and this will take him all of about a minute if he's really very slow. Now again, praying for him, as St. Monica did for like 20, 25 years for St. Augustine, did not move St. Augustine a bit. It could not. Now, you could argue that you could move a person by a sense of guilt or love. I recommend this all the time, that what you do is sort of nag people, and I was dealing with a guy earlier today on the concept of deathbed conversion. And what I said to him was that, because his father's very ill, and he thinks he might be literally dying, and his father's a very weird Catholic, obviously accepting some doctrines of the church and rejecting the others, was that you go to your father and say, listen, for my sake, at least give intellectual consent. So, you know, just go along with me. Just say yes and mean it, even though you don't like it, and that may get you into heaven. Okay, that's fine. But you see, you're not adding anything to God, and you're not bringing about the conversion, because the conversion is still an act of his own will to cooperate with the grace of God, because if that person brought about that conversion, then salvation would be a matter of works, human activity. And of course it can't be. And then, to follow the conclusion all the way through, that would mean if this fellow, who I spoke to earlier today, did not approach his father would die and go to hell, not because of the sins of the father, but because of the sin of the son to fail to love him enough. And nobody can go to hell because of the sin of another person. I mean, that's utter nonsense. We earn our way to hell. We accept the gift of salvation. But nobody else can be anything more than a willing instrument of God's will that he uses at the time. Again, to use, I think, a very simple analogy. If I go to Donald Trump and he's going to give me a check for a lot of money, I'd be happy because, you know, I'm getting money from him. Now, Donald Trump may pick up a pen and find out the pen doesn't work, so I give him my pen, and he uses my pen to write the check. Well, I'm not writing the check, and if you want to be, you know, very, very precise and rather foolish, you could say, well, my pen is actually writing the check to me. Well, okay. But it's really Donald Trump, and he could use any pen to write that check. And if the money is in the bank account, the check is good. And if the money isn't, it doesn't matter whether he uses the most expensive pen in the world or a broken pencil. If the money's there, the check's good. And if the money isn't, the check isn't any good. The pen is only an instrument which follows God's hand. Our job is to be the pen in God's hand by which the truth of God may become self-evident or more knowledgeable to a person, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, if you want to even work that they need it in writing, so to speak, as opposed to just in their conscience. We can do that. We can confirm their conscience. But that doesn't relieve their sin or disbelief. And again, this is a basic premise from which we must start and which we must finish. Sin is inexcusable battle. If sin were like gravity, And they will, you know, if you're on a bridge and you slip and you fall off, it doesn't matter whether you're good or bad, or if you did it by accident, or somebody pushed you, or you jumped, or the bridge people were negligent, or they were wonderful, or anything. You're going to fall. Because gravity is a law of nature which plays no favors and doesn't care about anybody. No one, again, to follow this thing out, if you fell off a bridge, or somebody threw you off a bridge, and you fell on someone else and killed them, everybody would say, well, gee, well, that's a terrible accident. But no one would charge you with murder, because once you fell off the bridge, you couldn't be responsible on how your body falls. No, it's a terrible accident. We're really sorry it happened, but no one would hold you responsible, because gravity cannot be avoided. In the same sense that, you know, if you're in an airplane and the pilot makes a mistake and the plane blows up and you fall on somebody, that's not your fault. We can maybe argue the pilot, but gee whiz, that's not your fault. You know, we're sorry that happened, and it's a human tragedy, but no moral guilt is put on you. Gravity is, in a sense, excusable. Because we can excuse gravity in the sense of, well, gee, we can't control that. But sin always involves an act of will of man, and therefore is never excusable. If sin were excusable in the same way that gravity is, then Jesus wouldn't have died on the cross to pay for the penalty of our sins. It's nonsense. I mean, he didn't die to pay for the penalty of us being subject to gravity, or for us shivering when we get cold or sweating when we get hot. I mean, these things simply happen. They're literally unavoidable. When we get tired, we fall asleep. I mean, again, think of this passage in Scripture where Jesus comes out and finds the apostles sleeping and says, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. He literally was excusing this because of their human nature. They woke him up and they fell asleep again, but he was saying, I understand. You had a meal, long day, you've had something to drink, you're tired, maybe things happen. So, but that's exactly the point. Judas was inexcusable, although maybe the apostles were excusable because they fell asleep even when they tried to keep awake. To summarize, to disbelieve is a sin. God's ability, his functioning, his all-encompassing love and all-encompassing power and everything else that applies to God cannot be added to by us. The only thing we can do is be on his side. In the same sense, you know, we can take that flea and throw it off to Queen Mary, but it really doesn't make a difference, you know. I try to use a simple analogy which I think works. A father is out washing his car, you know, and out comes his 2.5-year-old son. And the 2.5-year-old son asks, can I help you? So the father says, yeah. And the son takes the soapy sponge and puts the soap on the part of the car that's already been cleaned, and he knocks over the bucket with the water in it, and he steps on the hose and all of that stuff. In other words, the son doesn't do anything at all. But at the end, the father gives him a dollar and says, thanks, son, I couldn't have done it without you. Well, in fact, he didn't help at all. But the father judges the son's activities by his intention, by his desire to help his father. And so therefore he rewards them. But he didn't add anything to the act of the adult. And I think all of us who've ever either been children or had children know their parents do this. You know, the child, the little girl who thinks she's helping the mother bake the cake probably isn't helping at all. But the mother says, yeah, thank you very much, and you're a big help, Sally, and, you know, we did it together, and we're proud of daddy. That's a perfectly legitimate thing to do, and we all understand it's an act of love. But it didn't add anything to the skill of the mother. And in the same sense, the act of love for concern for the other person is a totally beneficial thing, and it's the way we should act. But we must be sure that we never get into Pelagianism or any kind of sense of pride where we think that God needs us, or that we're actually adding to God's power or his plan or anything like that. The best we can be is a willing instrument of his will and fit into his plan. But we've got to understand that if we're not willing and if we don't fit into his plan, he's not going to be stymied by that. He's not going to run into a roadblock. I did a tape on this called The God of History and The God of Time, and what I suggest is that we look at time quite different than God in time as opposed to out of time recreating every moment. It is not technically the proper way, but for conceptual purposes, it makes it easier, I think, to understand what I'm trying to drive, trying to get at. But anyway, I hope that's my answer. Did he get across, Walt?
What?
Did he get across?
Well, I think so.
Okay.
Let me ask you this, though. Then why should she pray for Tom or I pray for her vocation or anything like that?
Well, I have a rather radical view on prayer, okay? But there's a whole bunch of reasons for prayer, but if you're talking about this type, which is essentially petitionary prayer, and we're not talking about something that's arbitrary, like I pray a lot for the Dallas Cowboys, but I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure if God gets involved in that, but that's another point. But talking about the benefit of another person, there's two massive reasons that I can see. Number one, it is truly an expression of love. So that, and after all, as St. Paul says, you know, if I've got this and I've got that and I've got all these other virtues and I don't have charity, and that's what I mean, actually, technically, we're talking about Christian charity. If I don't have Christian charity, I'm nothing. So therefore, the prayer for another person is a natural expression and a supernatural expression of the theological virtue of charity, which is necessary for one's salvation. Second thing is, when you are thinking of another person in a sense like that, it is very hard to sin. When you are praying, it's hard to sin. If you're really worried, if you're at a deathbed of a person who's about to die, and you're worried about the salvation of their soul, and you're there praying, pouring out rosaries, well, that's a pretty hard time to start being slothful or lustful or angry. It really is. So the point is, prayer is a very good way to avoid sinning. And if you avoid sinning enough, you get to heaven. And it's that simple. I mean, I always reduce it. I try frequently to reduce things to the simplest thing. And that is, if you analyze the amount of time during a day that you can sin, it really isn't that much. Because you can't sin when you're asleep. And there's a lot of other times it's very hard to sin. When you're tying your shoelaces and when you're closing doors and putting things in the refrigerator, your mind is concentrating on the task at hand, so it's very, very hard to sin. So you can take your sort of free sin time, which probably runs about 2 hours a day, and if you can fill, say, a half hour of that with prayer, well, then you're down to an hour and a half a day where you can sin. And that's a pretty good ratio. It's probably about an 8-to-1 ratio of non-sinning versus sinning. And if you can increase the non-sinning time and decrease the sinning time, you'll be safe. So prayer is an excellent thing for a lot of reasons. But I think the simplest one and the most self-serving one is that when you're praying, even though your mind might wander, it's really very hard to sin. It puts you in the right disposition to be in touch with God. And again, it's an act of charity. So I pray for people all the time, even though intellectually I could argue that I'm not adding anything to them, but this is a formal approval for those that I pray for, in a sense that I pray for their efforts, and then sometimes a formal acknowledgement that I'm worried about those others that I pray for. Okay? And I've done that. Just as an interesting aside, I used to pray for a woman who did me a great deal of harm, at least on a secular basis. And I prayed for her for quite a long time, almost daily. And then I decided that I would pray for someone else. And that night she called me up and said that she thought I had died. She had gotten the 7/3 that I had ceased to exist. And I thought that was very interesting, that obviously my prayers had some effect with her. But affect, literally, not effect. That didn't mean God now withdrew help from her or offered her help that he wasn't offering her before. No, but there was some bond between us, which was maintained by prayer. There's a million reasons to pray, all of which are good, but we have to be clear that we're not becoming a substitute for God if he's incomplete without us. But
this ends side one. Please turn over to side two. Side two, continued.
There's a million reasons to pray, all of which are good, but we have to be clear that we're not becoming a substitute for God if he's incomplete without us. That's dangerous. That goes against the majesty of God, and it ultimately goes into Protestantism.
Okay. So,
was there another question?
Yes. What about just a couple? Would sacrifice be the same answer? Why should she any of us make a sacrifice?
Yeah. Well, sacrifices. I would say so. A sacrifice is a very good thing to do for a thousand reasons. Okay. One is that you can sacrifice with the dead in purgatory, certainly. Perhaps, I don't know, maybe we could even do that on Earth. Perhaps it is possible that we may be able to endure the sufferings of others on Earth. And therefore, in that sense alone, that would be certainly a marvelous charitable act. But also, again, sacrifice for the benefit of another person, even if it doesn't come about because of what I've explained, is still a charitable act, and it will benefit that person. And, of course, any sacrifice, again, puts you in a disposition not to sin. So I would say the same reasoning applies. Just from the point of view of this, if you pray for one person, you're sacrificing the time and effort that you could do other things. So I would say even prayer for the quote-unquote benefit of another person would be a sacrifice. So I would say, yeah, they're both things are conceptually the same.
That would be like putting the pebbles in your shoes or wearing a hair shirt or something like that.
Yeah, again, it could be done for several different reasons. One is you could offer it up for the dead. You could offer it up for yourself. The other is you could simply be mortifying your flesh. But if you did it for another person, again, you could say, I mean, I see it as a perfectly legitimate prayer to say, listen, that person's going through a great deal of pain right now, Lord, give me some of it. I will willingly take on the sufferings of some other people. That's a very Christ-like attitude. And so if you were to intentionally inflict pain on yourself for that reason, again, it's just an act of charity. And the act of charity is always, you know, that's the essence of Christian morality.
All right, let me turn on the tape recorder again. Could you hear that?
Yeah, no problem.
All right.
Okay, at the risk of trying to cut this short, simply to make it inductive as opposed to deductive, the concept of baptism of desire is unfortunately wrong. I know Father Hardin includes that in his catechism, but one of the problems is that to accept Father Hardin, regardless of how much goodwill he is, has in him or doesn't have in him, what we're doing is we're interposing yet another person between ourselves and God. That's the problem with any book. So what I try to do is instead deal with issues in which we can make it much clearer. Okay. So let me deal with two aspects of this rather than going into great length on the whole concept of baptism of desire and desire of baptism and the mistranslations of the Council of Trent and all this other stuff. Number one, if there were such a thing as a good Buddhist or Hindu who did desire baptism in the sense of, gee whiz, I think Hinduism is correct, this is the way I'm supposed to live, and if someone were to show me the truth, I would accept it. Then, from God's point of view, what would prevent God from giving this person the truth? Again, think about it. If the person desires truth and is living in accord with the partial truth that he has, and is of such a personality or will that he would accept the entire truth if presented to him, how could God not present it to him? In other words, the only way we could say that God could not, would not, is that he could not. Because God, who can withhold nothing good from us, would present good to this man if this man desired it. And that's what baptism of desire means, a man who desires the good. Therefore, any good Hindu would have to be presented with the truth. Now, one would argue, well, gee whiz, he lives in the middle of a village in northern India, and there aren't any priests around him, he doesn't know any Catholics, and blah, 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 and this and that. Right. Let's presume, again, I'm not saying, by the way, the Hindus are good. Personally, I couldn't even conceive of a good Hindu, and I'll try to get to that in a moment. But the point is, if this guy did exist, then why do we not go by the passage in Scripture which tells us exactly of a situation like this? A man who did not know of the truth of the Catholic Church and lived in accord with God's will as best he knew it at the time. And the man was called Saint Joseph, and the man didn't understand or know about the virgin birth, he thought his espoused wife's blessed mother had been cheating on him. After all, she was pregnant, and he knew he wasn't the father. So he put two and two together and came up with four, and said, well, gee whiz, she's been adulterous, I'm going to put her away. And an angel came at night and said, don't do that. Don't worry. This is God's plan. And St. Joseph, being a just man, of course, accepted the word of the angel. Do we not believe, I mean, we have to believe that happened because it's in the Bible. We have to believe this happened. This was a just man, invincibly ignorant of one of the doctrines of the faith. So God said, I'm going to make sure that he will not make a mistake, and I will send an angel to him. So, unless we are now to believe that God won't do these things anymore, or the Bible is false, we must conclude that this good Hindu would be visited by an angel, or visited by a priest or someone, in order to receive baptism and save his soul. Now, we have what appears to be, I say appears to be because we do not know what happens in their dreams. We have what appears to be situations where these people are not presented with the truth, and we would say, isn't that cruel? No. Just as an aside, Jesus clearly tells his followers not to cast pearls before swine and not to give what is holy before dogs. He tells his followers that when they go into a town, not to go door to door. If you are accepted in one house, stay at that house and let people come to you. And if they reject you in that village, walk away and shake the dust of that town off your sandals. What Jesus is saying is, don't preach the word to everybody. To those who will not accept it, don't even bother. Now, unless we are to work on the concept that God doesn't know what he's doing, those people who are not given the message while alive are those who would not accept it, and therefore God is following the principle which Jesus tells us to follow. Of course, he couldn't do anything immoral anyway, of don't cast your pearls before swine. Now, the point is simply this, though, as a separate matter, I said I would get to it. Again, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, Mohammedism, any of that stuff, Rabbinic Judaism, if anyone were to examine any of that stuff, you would find that it is completely, intrinsically evil. Now, I'm not saying different. I'm saying evil. Hinduism and Buddhism is based on one premise, as far as your behavior goes. Complete and utter indifference to the benefit and the sufferings of your fellow man. Buddha says, and the Hindu holy men will tell you, if you see someone hit by a car in the street, the proper thing to do is to walk by it. Have no involvement whatsoever, so that you will reduce your karma and get off the wheel of samsari, and you will achieve nirvana, which is non-existent. That is evil. Any Hindu who accepts that system is a man who has embraced evil. There is no such thing as a good Hindu. Islam, Mohammedism, teaches that if a man were a Mohammedan, and then he becomes an apostate, that not only are you allowed to kill him, but you are allowed to kill his wife and his children unto infinite generations. That is an evil system. Rabbinic Judaism teaches that God himself cannot forgive sins unless man forgives him. That is blasphemy. That is an evil system. No matter which one of these systems you examine, you will find they are evil. Hinduism advocated human sacrifice, still probably does, probably can't get away with it, called sitti, in which women are burnt on funeral pyres of their husbands. It is considered a virtuous and meritorious act for a woman to kill herself. Now, this is a harm. This is a murder. This is human sacrifice. This is Hinduism. All of those systems are evil. And any man who stays within them and likes them is working against the conscience that God gives him, and therefore is consciously embracing evil, consciously rejecting good, and consciously on the road to hell. So now, again, if he's a good Hindu, that is, he behaves in Hinduism correctly, he couldn't possibly have baptism of desire. If he were a bad Hindu who hates the system, then he might have baptism of desire in no matter what Father Hardin means by it. But then, why would God not send him an angel at night, even if he doesn't send him a bilocated priest? Why does he not send him an angel at night if they get up and walk the 400 miles to find the local Catholic to get baptized? Because that's exactly what God did in the New Testament. And it is exactly what God did with the Ethiopian eunuch in the Acts of the Apostles when St. Philip was transported to the Ethiopian eunuch. This man was seeking the truth, and God made sure he found it. Remember what Jesus says. He who seeks, finds. He who asks for it, receives. He who knocks, has it open. Now, he either meant it or he didn't. If he meant it, he who seeks salvation, which requires water baptism, will find it. Because Jesus didn't lie. I think that should answer the question.
Well, I think so.
Was that the last question, Paul?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
She's an inquisitive little soul.
I don't mind. It's perfectly valid. I mean, but the only thing I would say is...
Well, no, she's going to probably bring this up when she gets back to the convent.
Oh, well, that's it. Now it's a matter of prudence, okay? Let me put it this way, and I'm making a suggestion here. There's a certain... You can't ever betray the faith. By the same token, there are times when, for prudence, it is proper to keep your mouth shut in public and talk things over privately. I would say that if she's in a situation which is awkward and is such that she's required to put an answer down on a piece of paper, which goes against the true teachings of the faith, but maybe goes along with what Father Hardin says, a way to Jesuitically avoid this might be to put the answer to this question is the following, and then put it in. Instead of saying a person is saved by a baptism of desire, she could write down, the answer which you want is as follows, a person is saved by baptism of desire. Then she's not saying she believes it, she's simply saying, this is the answer you're looking for, and I was paying attention in class. And that's a questionable situation, because the point is, if you bring it up on, say, the very first day, there's a darn good, especially if you bring it up in class, there's a darn good chance they'll throw you out. That might be a good thing in the long run, but it wouldn't be a good thing in the long run as far as evangelistic efforts of trying to show other people what is right and wrong. So there might be a situation where either in open discussion time or in private, where she might be able to talk to the instructor and say, hey, listen, and this is why I suggest again that the ultimate thing she could always do is give him my telephone number and say, call this guy. And then I'll take the grunt at that point, okay? And she could simply say, listen, I heard him. He made a lot of sense. Perhaps you would like to talk to him also. And if you could record that conversation, then I could hear both sides of the argument, and that way I would feel much better. That's a little bit harder to resist than just saying, hey, listen, you're all wrong on this. She could phrase it in a more, again, not denying the faith, phrase it in a more subjective fashion to induce other people to come to the truth. It's a matter of using the best means to the end. We're never allowed to deny the faith, but sometimes we can present it in an invitational as opposed to a confrontational fashion. And I'm not saying she should do it either way. I'm simply making a proposal that she might want to consider. Okay? All right, once again, Walt, if you could duplicate this tape, I'd appreciate it, okay?
Well, it's duplicated, and it'll be on its way.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
God bless you. Bye.
We now continue on another tape.
God is love, works with love and through love, and has nothing to do with evil. We cannot add anything to his perfection. He is the perfection itself through charity and never denies his children any good thing. But what if a person is so lost and desensitized to the truth through the lies of the world, doesn't know where to turn, has been deceived by Satan to believe a lie, and really believes through the reinforcement of other lost souls that he is lost. For instance, the Protestant. I know a devout Protestant who is searching for God's will in his daily life. He wants to understand what Jesus wants him to do. He cannot even make decisions very well, parentheses, daily decisions, for fear he'll do the opposite of God's will. He's about 30 now and is open to so many things. However, he has a problem with the devotion to Mary. He needs the grace to be open to this, to accept it, but perhaps he is reluctant to ask, afraid that the devil might influence and trick him to stray from the direct line to Jesus. He doesn't want to lose that. He may believe Marian's devotion is evil because it takes one away from Jesus. He doesn't understand. Now, Jesus said, ask and you shall receive. If we don't ask, we won't receive. Yes, God holds all the grace for this guy to be converted and doesn't need my prayer for him, but God wants it because God receives love and releases it as charity to those in need. If a person is deceived, he doesn't know to ask necessarily, so we ask for him. Our time, energy, and act of love is a gift to him, as Jesus prayed that Peter may not fall from the faith after denying him. The prayer, truth, does not add anything to God, but gives what was never asked for, an act of charity to someone else. Now, how Jesus wants to bring about that change of heart or conversion is, of course, up to him. He can inspire, send someone in his life through whom the truth is revealed, but the lost soul can still reject the truth. However, perhaps the 15 people are sent to reveal it to him, the repetition might be enough to bring the individual to accept God's revelation, parentheses, the conversion, and it was through someone's prayer. Perhaps because I asked for a conversion for someone and God chose to share with the person an enlightenment, for example, that the Magnificat really penetrated the soul and they came to understand and accept the love of the Blessed Mother, thus leading up to the truths of Our Lady. That enlightenment was never asked for before, but as an act of love and charity, God gives it to the person because they never asked for it, only because they were deceived. It was given because we cared enough, we loved. Even Our Lady, St. Catherine Labouré, said these are the graces that no one ever asked for. In Fatima, she said, when showing hell to the children, see the place where poor sinners go because there is none to pray and make sacrifices for them. To sum it up, a person who is deceived is afraid to stray from the path they are walking for fear it's from the evil one. Just to emphasize the point, we would never dream of joining the Baptist Church, so our act of love and prayer is pleasing to God from someone because he loves us, because we ask, and we have to ask, or someone does, to receive. Otherwise, why would it be necessary for the Blessed Mother to pray for us sinners? What is she asking for? Enlightenment, change of heart, etc., which are all under the generic title of conversion. Still, the person has to accept that the grace is sent to be so numerous to triggering the person, the conversion for the enlightenment, so clear, so to illumine his scope of understanding, and that's it. That's the question.
Okay. This one, it deals, of course, with the issues we've been dealing with before. But there was one massive error in the premise, which I think explains some of it. Jesus certainly says, ask and you shall receive. And she then said, and if we don't ask, we will not receive. That does not follow at all. The nature of a gift is simply that you can't make any kind of legal claim on somebody for it. You haven't earned it. You can ask for a gift, or you can receive one without asking for it. We have a situation in Scripture where Jesus confronts people and just says, hey, come and follow me. And we have other cases where people essentially have asked him for things. Well, in one case, we have the situation where he asks, he confronts them. Again, there may be more to this than we know because of the story. But as an example, when he confronts the Samaritan woman at the well, he asks her for a drink. She doesn't come to him and say, oh, you know, good sir, could you try to teach me something about God so I can be saved? He is certainly giving her a gift, but she didn't ask for it. And from her attitude, we can conclude that she wasn't looking for it. She was obviously a person living in a bad state and a Samaritan, so she was religiously and morally incorrect. My point is that simply because we are told that if we ask for something, we shall receive it, does not mean we will not receive it if we don't ask for it. That's number one. Number two, the situations he sets up could be very true. We certainly could imagine without a problem a situation where a person having been some confused or misled or sin clouded.
Well, that ends the recorded part. That is the telephone recorded part of this tape. I hope that the technical difficulties and the, at times, low quality of the recording was not so bad that you failed to understand what was being said. And as there is a significant space on this tape, and that is, it is not my policy to sell empty tapes, I shall ramble, I hope, in a coherent fashion, and hopefully expound, I hope I shall expound a little more on some of the subjects and some of the implications raised in the discussions. Basically, I believe that all theological discussions and all religious discussions should ultimately center around the issue of salvation. Nothing else really matters. So let me try to put the concept of salvation in a context which is related to the issues we're dealing with here. Salvation is a gift. It is given by God to man. It may come to man by means of another man, in the sense that we may receive the sacraments from another person, we may learn the truths necessary for salvation from men. All of those things are facts. However, and nonetheless, salvation is a gift from God to man. If God wills a man to achieve the necessary information, the necessary grace for salvation, and in fact, God does will that. That does not mean to say that God wills that all men will necessarily be saved. That is a Presbyterian position. I am simply saying that God has a plan by which all men may be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth. The truth being those doctrines and dogmas necessary for man to affirm to be saved. God has a plan by which that may occur. That plan involves the bestowal or the offering of the gift of salvation onto individuals. What God wills cannot be interfered with by man. By this I mean that God cannot be frustrated in his plan by the activity of man. Sin is not more powerful than God. We can only go to hell because of our own individual sins, not because of the sins of anyone else. I believe that this is completely misunderstood in contemporary Catholic thinking and, shall we say, intellectual endeavors and contemporary Catholic thought. We'll have to put quotation marks around the word Catholic in this case. I have recently come across several instances in which supposed Catholic writers have used the term lost one's faith. It is impossible to lose one's faith if that faith is in fact the Catholic faith, because that Catholic faith is a gift from God, given to us, infused in us at the time of our valid baptisms. This faith may be rejected, it may be thrown away, or it may be destroyed, but only by the active act of will of the person who has received that faith. No amount of reasoning, no amount of suggestion, no amount of coercion, no amount of implication, no amount of fancy education on the higher collegiate level can possibly destroy anyone's faith. Why? Because the faith is a gift from God, and it is the basis for the individual relation between God and man, and it is supernatural and cannot be damaged by anything other than the active sin of the individual involved. So in other words, the faith can be thrown away, can be rejected, can be ignored, can be abandoned, but it cannot be lost. This is why, in a very real sense, we cannot, quote, convert, unquote, anyone. To accept faith is always an act of free will on one's part. Will always precedes the intellect or the mind in these matters. In other words, people of good will are they who are predisposed to accept the truths that God will present to them. People of bad will are those who are predisposed to reject the truths that God will present to them. People of good will agree with one another. People of good will are charitable towards one another. This does not mean, of course, that people of goodwill do not sin. Of course they do. And people of goodwill may, in fact, still be damned. I am simply saying, as a general statement, that it is the act of will which each individual controls because he has free will, which ultimately determines whether a person will be an acceptor of the faith or a rejecter of the faith. All of the intellectual arguments, all of the proofs, all of the apologetic and evangelistic techniques can, at best, somewhat influence, that is, be a factor in determining, or shall we say, changing the will of a person from bad will to good will. A good-willed person will accept immediately the truths of the faith upon presentation. I say immediately because a good-willed person will act actively with actual grace, which is always present, and which always will allow him to recognize good, to reject evil. I point out that the issues raised by the person who is asking the question deal with some of these issues directly, and some of them only in, shall we say, an elusive fashion. That's why I'm trying to clear the matter up now. The basic premise under which all theological issues should be examined is as follows. It is God who brings about our salvation. It is we ourselves who bring about our damnation, and we bring about our damnation of ourselves. Anything that goes against this dual premise, anything which conflicts with this dual premise, is wrong. Let me repeat it. God, being all-powerful, is he who brings about the salvation of man, that is, the entry into heaven of man, upon being judged worthy of it after his death. God does that. We do not. At best, we cooperate with the grace of God
and we have a role. We are a factor in our salvation. But we cannot bring it about by ourselves. We do, by ourselves, bring about our own damnations. This must be understood. There are times when we talk about saving the souls of others. Sometimes we're sloppy in our language. Sometimes it's a sort of idiomatic shorthand, a verbal shorthand. We know what we mean technically, and we don't feel as if we have to go through a very precise exposition of exactly what we mean. When we are speaking in that shorthand and everybody understands us, there's probably nothing wrong with it, although it always could be potentially dangerous. When we are speaking with people of other religions or alleged Catholics who don't understand Catholic theology correctly, then I think it is very important for us to be as precise as possible. And that brings up another point. Sometimes, because simply of the limitations of language and perhaps even the limitations of English, we are not able to correctly and precisely express completely what we are trying to say. There is a very commonly accepted premise that God is beyond human comprehension, not only in the sense that God is totally beyond us, but that any attempt to describe or to convey information about God by means of language is necessarily inadequate. Even if we say God is all-powerful, I'm not particularly sure if the human mind can comprehend what all-powerful actually means. Nonetheless, we have only language with which to communicate. Therefore, I think that what has happened, and one of the reasons we have gotten into such sloppiness in theology, outside of the fact that there are a lot of malicious people trying to destroy the faith, and trying to confuse, and trying to mislead, and simply plain lying, outside of that fact, we have the situation that as we get more into the casual approaches to theology, as we become more and more relaxed in our language, we can sometimes fail to convey precisely what we mean. I think it is important, therefore, at certain times, and I hope that this was one of the things I accomplished in this particular product, at certain times we go back to the beginning and begin with the essentials and then inductively build up the argument. Start with the individual relationship or the individual necessary characteristic of a situation, a status, an object, a concept, an idea, and from that build upwards. This is primarily the inductive approach which I use and which I advocate in many ARM products. Again, the individual characteristic of the individual relationship between God and man is that God loves man, each individual man. Jesus died for mankind, which means every individual who ever lived, and every individual is given the opportunity to accept the gift of salvation of God, cooperate with the grace of God, and merit salvation. By the same token, every individual has the possibility of achieving his own damnation. No one can interfere with that. No one can stand between God and man in a way to prevent the grace of God from getting to men. I would like to make a personal comment here. Once at a conference, a number of alleged Catholics were, as most alleged Catholics do, finding fault with what I was saying. The reason was not that they found anything wrong with what I was saying. There was nothing wrong with what I was saying. It was that I was demanding that they actually put their faith into action instead of sitting around at conferences, comfortable chairs, having good meals, patting each other on the back and calling that Catholic action. I don't call it Catholic action. I call it the sin of sloth, and a sin of complacency and pride, all of which, of course, carried to their logical conclusion, will lead to damnation. So I was pushing, I was nagging, I was pestering that these people would do something, that they would evangelize, that they would defend the faith, that they would live the faith. And again, objections were raised which were vague, amorphous. And I demanded that people would attack me if they felt there were anything wrong, but only if they took an oath, and only if they made it specific and offered testimony, almost as if it were a trial. So I put myself and the organization on trial, and a few did come forth to testify against me. And one man said, and it's sort of frightening, because I kept asking him if he understood he was under oath, that if I personally, quote, turned off, unquote, another person, if I, Vin Lewis, took the wrong approach to an individual, and because of that, that individual got angry at me, and then expanding from me, got angry at the Catholic Church, that God was not capable of finding another medium to get the message across. In other words, what he was saying was, is that I, Vin Lewis, could prevent God from reaching individuals. And when I asked them this question in a sense of cross-examination in about four different ways or five different ways, saying, do you realize what you're saying? You're saying that if I fail, this man goes to hell because of something I did. And he said, yes, that's true. It was a frightening statement, but one that is far too often expressed. Those who think that I can do that, or any of you think that you, if you quote-unquote fail to get the message across to anybody, that that person is now going to go to hell because of your failure, your efforts. You are deluding yourself, and you're guilty of a very serious sin of pride. For never fail to remember, God doesn't need you. As Jesus said when entering Jerusalem in triumph, the Pharisees said, tell these people to keep quiet because the Romans will get upset. They'll consider it a riot. And he said, if I told them to keep quiet, the stones themselves would cry out. It's interesting because there was another time Jesus mentioned stones when he was arguing with the Pharisaical Jews, and they were praising themselves because they were sons of Abraham. And Jesus said, God can make stones into sons of Abraham. Taking these two passages together, what does it mean? The God who created Adam and Eve out of dust or clay and created the earth at the command of his word certainly doesn't need us to get his message across to people. It is we who need to do his will in order that we may merit the gift of salvation. Pray for others, of course, but never, never, never go against that dual premise. Number one, God is all-powerful, and it is he who achieves our salvation. Number two, it is we who individually, for ourselves, achieve and bring about our respective damnation. I cannot damn you. I cannot save you. I can damn myself. I cannot save myself. All theology should be consistent with this premise, regardless of how sentimental and how emotional we become and how loving in a human sense we are of other people. We must never forget those two premises. With that in mind, I hope that you found this tape to be of use. I hope that you found it edifying, educational, inspirational, and I hope, of course, that it leads to more than simply a gain in knowledge. I hope that it leads also to an encouragement for action. We are not to be library book Catholics, that is to say, people who simply read books and go to the library and read more books. We are to be Catholics who must remember that one of the standards by which we will be judged by is how we treated our fellow man. For if we do not think of those fellow men as as they, that is to say, the least of the brothers of Jesus, as Jesus himself, we will not be saved. For that's what Jesus assures us in Matthew 25. With that in mind, I would simply say, I thank you for listening. I hope it's been of use to you. And I'm always interested in your comments, suggestions, or criticisms, especially if you want to have them recorded. This has been Lewis, advising you that additional copies of this tape, or any of the tapes which you may, which ARM produces, you may obtain by contacting us at ARM, which stands, of course, for All Roads Ministry, 55 Palen, that's P as in Paul, A-L-E-N, Road, number 38, Hopewell Junction, New York, 12533. Hopewell is one word and spelt exactly as it sounds. Thank you for listening. God bless.